Thank you, Stephen, and good evening, everyone. Thanks for joining us this evening, especially since we're so few in number and due to the Shawnigan Conference. So tonight we have before us Judah the man, and just to give sort of a brief outline of where we're going, God willing, over the next three classes, although not three consecutive weeks. Tonight we'll look at Judah the man, so it'll be a bit of a character study, and then in 2 weeks' time we'll look at Judah the tribe, and then I think it's at the end of June we'll look at Judah the nation. And so although these will end up being sort of classes that are distinct and sort of separate, we'll try to see some threads and some links between them as we sort of journey between Judah the man, the tribe, and the nation. And as we go through these classes, we'll try to do a few things. We'll try to pick out some of the facts, which can often be the sort of the boring part of a class or a study. But I think, especially in this first class with Judah the man, it's really an important thing that we kind of look at some of the facts and look at some of the history and the family history and pick some of these things out, that we sort of get our minds into where Judah's at, I think. Because there's not a lot really specifically written about Judah himself, but there is a lot of sort of backstory with the family and what's going on in the chapters in Genesis. So then in the class, Judah the tribe, we'll sort of carry on from the end of Genesis and the blessings given to Judah, and we'll look for some lessons and some principles drawn out there from Judah the tribe. And then getting into Judah the nation, we probably won't focus so much on the historical aspect of that, but we'll probably, because I haven't prepared a lot of that class yet, we'll probably look to sort of spiritual Judah, spiritual nation, and where we go with that. So we'll be looking for, as I said, three things. We'll be looking for to draw out the facts, and then we'll look to sort of establish some of the principles that come out that we might learn some lessons from Judah's life, and then in the subsequent classes from that material, and that we might get some form of exhortation or encouragement or warnings, things that we can use and utilize in our own lives that might help us to overcome some things. So just an outline then for this class. We'll look at Judah's family background. We'll look at the family members that influence his upbringing, which is, I think, pretty much all of them to some degree, and his life as a young man, even though we don't have a lot specifically written about him in that time. We'll look at his role in some of the major events that go on within the family and with him. So we'll look at what happens in the events of Shechem and Dinah. We'll look here in chapter 37, which we had read, with Joseph, and of course with the event with Tamar. We'll look at the period of darkness, really, that Judah kind of goes into in his life personally, while Joseph is in Egypt. in chapter 38. And then we'll sort of see Judah maturing into the role of a leader of the household, sort of under his father, and Judah's redemption. And then we'll finish with the blessing of Judah from his father Israel. So Judah's family, I think we'd all agree it's quite an interesting family. These are all things that we know, but I thought that we'd just talk about them and bring them out and highlight them, that we sort of have this backstory fresh in our minds, so that we get a picture of Judah that I think is a bit more complete. So we've got Jacob. He's got his two wives, Leah and Rachel, and then he's also got these two other wives, which were the handmaids of Leah and Rachel, Zilpah and Bilhah. So Judah's mother is Leah. The first four sons of Jacob are Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. So Judah's the fourth born of Jacob. Then we have the events earlier in Genesis, where Rachel can't have children, so she gives Bilhah to Jacob to have children with, and so Dan and Naphtali are born. So they're the fifth and sixth brothers. And then sort of as a, I don't know, retribution is the right word, but sort of as a response to that, Leah gives Zilpah to Jacob. So then Gad and Asher are born. So they're seven and eight. And then Leah has another three children, Issachar, Zebulun, and Dinah. So they're 9, 10, and 11. And then after that, Joseph and Benjamin are born to Rachel. We have quite a period of time between Joseph and Benjamin being born. So they're 12 and 13, so 12 brothers and one daughter that we have recorded. And they're, I'm not going to get into it tonight, but there may be some evidence that there were other daughters as well. So I think it's interesting to note, too, that Leah names Zilpah's boys, and Rachel names Bilhah's boys. So in this sort of, at least from today's standards, an unconventional family, and sort of a family that is sort of dealing with a lot of strife and pulling in different ways, this would have been very different, I think, to what most all of us would have grown up with. And I just think it's interesting to think about that and about some of the events that happen in that time, where this family, Jacob's having all these sons and daughter, possibly daughters, and they're growing up and they're dealing with a lot of issues. And there's other family members, so not that we have a lot specifically written about Judah in relation to other family members. I think he would have at least known something about them, and been influenced in some way with the other family members. So there's Esau, Uncle Esau. That's, a bit of a different person that you're sort of looking at as somewhat of a close family member, although they didn't live together. And you've got this big list of Esau's sons, which would have been his cousins. And I think there's some evidence later on that possibly Judah is jealous in a way of Esau's sons. because they seem to sort of be quite prosperous and have a certain way of life, and it seems like Judah might be jealous of that. And you've got Laban, so which would have been his grandfather, Leah and Rachel's father. And we know a bit about Laban. He was sort of an interesting character as well. And then I sort of asked, you know, myself, and I'll throw it out there, you know, like, what did he really know about Isaac and Rebekah? What did he know about Abraham and Sarah or Ishmael? So surely he would have been told about their ancestry, and he would have been told about you know, the promises that were given to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because these things were very important to Jacob. So although it doesn't explicitly say a lot of these things, I think just from you know, thinking about it from a family perspective, and what they would have discussed, I think these things are interesting to think about, that you know, Judah grew up in this way with sort of a fractured or a sort of a family that's got different compartments, and he's got this strong ancestry with promises from God. And actually, just of note, it's you know, Isaac doesn't die until chapter 35, so it's there's some, you know, the event there where actually, maybe I'll just flip there so I get this right. At the end of chapter 35, Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre of Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had sojourned. Now the days of Isaac were 180 years. Isaac breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people, an old man of ripe age, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. So chapter 35 basically takes place, or the death of Isaac takes place after all of Jacob's family's sons and daughter are born. Judah would have been, being the fourthborn, he would have been grown up, I think. I didn't do a lot of study into what all the ages of everyone were at different points, but I think it's pretty safe to say he was essentially grown up and would have known what was going on. So just interesting to note that Isaac was still alive when they were all, when all the offspring of Jacob were alive. Now, said we'd look at a couple of, before we get into chapter 37, just think about the events that happened, a couple of events that happened that probably would have influenced Judah's upbringing and his sort of outlook on life. One of them being back when he would have been a child. Sorry, let me just find this verse. Back in chapter 30 and verse 18, you've got this strife going on between Leah and Rachel. And I think I've written down the wrong verse, but yeah, sorry. Up in verse 14, around verse 14 of chapter 30. So this is when Reuben goes out and finds these mandrakes in the field. So in the days of wheat harvest, Reuben went and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah. And Rachel said to Leah, "Please give me some of your son's mandrakes." But she said to her, "Is it a small matter for you to take my husband? And would you take my son's mandrakes also?" So Rachel said, "Therefore he may lie with you tonight in return for your son's mandrakes." And so I think, you know, it's not that it's comical, but it's almost like sort of a overgrown event that happens, you know, like these women are so against each other that they're trading, you know, plants that they're finding out in the field for Jacob's attention, and Judah grew up with this kind of strife between Jacob's wives. So that's one, and I think there's other events too where Judah would have been influenced in this way from all this family strife. Another one, so much later on, then I said we'd look at the event of Shechem and Dinah. Let's look at that briefly. So in chapter 34 is when Dinah's taken by this man Shechem, and the sons of Jacob don't like that very much. So Simeon and Levi decide to take matters into their own hands, and they end up slaying all the men of the males of the Shechemites. So, while again there isn't any direct evidence that I could find of Judah being involved in this act, he was certainly a grown man. He would have known what was going on and seen the treachery that was going on with his two brothers. And I think it's near the end of the chapter that it's a bit unknown, at least in my mind, but it says that the brethren, after this had taken place, they sort of looted the land, or looted these Shechemites and took their things, and it says that Jacob's sons, the brethren, had done this. So whether Judah was involved with that part of it or not, I don't think is conclusive, but it's possible, and it's just another event that I think really impacted Judah's thinking an outlook on what life was like and what was possible and you know where he was putting his priorities when he sees his two of his older brothers go and do this horrible thing. So moving on to chapter 37 then. And we had chapter 37 read because this is really the first occurrence that we read of Judah saying and doing something. And I think first occurrences of things in the Bible are quite significant. So verse 26 and 27 are the first is the first occurrence of Judah saying something and really, really doing something. And it's not a good start for him. It's not a good start in the record when this is the first thing that's recorded about you. But we'll look at Judah's role in this plan that they come up with in verse 26 and 27. And this plan to sell Joseph and the planned deception of their father, Jacob. So his role really was a role of leadership. I think it's something that he wanted to take. It's something that he desired in his life to be prominent in the family. And that's something that we see all the brothers being jealous of Joseph in this chapter, that that he was preferred of his father, and that he was having these dreams, and maybe it wasn't such a good idea to be telling them about them because it made that jealousy worse, but that's something that all these brothers had towards Joseph. But I think Judah really, really desired that sort of role of headship in the family under his father. And I think he expected it to some degree, because we've now gone through this event with Shechem and Dinah. And so Simeon and Levi have kind of been disqualified from that position in a way because of what they've done. And Reuben, back in chapter 35, verse 22, has defiled his father's bed by lying with Bilhah. So Reuben, the firstborn, has also, in a way, been disqualified from this role of being head in the head in the house, or head amongst the brethren. So what appears to be the main driver in Judah's plan, in which his brothers are complicit in here in chapter 37? Well, I think it's profit. It says right there in verse 26, Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. And not just profit, because we know that they received 20 pieces of silver, not just the profit of money, but I think he was looking for that profit of getting rid of Joseph and grasping hold of that headship role in the family. He wanted some power. He thought he could just take that high position in his father Jacob's eyes and gain that favorite spot and earn a little money on the side while selling Joseph as a slave. Now, does this event make us think at all of Jesus' betrayal by Judas? It did for me. So I'll just turn over to Matthew chapter 26 and verse 14. This is where Judas bargains for the betrayal. Matthew 26, verse 14. Then one of the 12, named Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, "What are you willing to give me to betray him to you?" And they weighed out 30 pieces of silver to him. From then on, he began looking for an opportunity to betray Jesus. And then in just the next chapter, Matthew 27, Judas feels remorse. Matthew 27, verse 1. And when morning came, all the chief priests and the elders of the people conferred together against Jesus to put him to death. And they bound him and led him away and delivered him to Pilate, the governor. Then when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that he had been condemned, he felt remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, "I have sinned by betraying innocent blood." But they said, "What is that to us? See to that yourself." And he threw the pieces of silver into the temple sanctuary and departed, and he went away and hanged himself. The chief priests took the pieces of silver and said, "It is not lawful to put them into the temple treasury, since it is the price of blood." And they conferred together and with the money bought the potter's field as a burial place for strangers. For this reason, that field has been called the field of blood to this day. Then that which was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. And they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of the one whose price had been set by the sons of Israel. And they gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord directed me. So although Judas feels sorry for what he did in betraying Jesus, he doesn't feel that he can go on and decided to take his own life. He doesn't seek forgiveness or a path to be reconciled. Judah, on the other hand, goes through a lot, many years, before he seems to feel remorse, whereas Judas feels remorse pretty soon after. But Judah does eventually acknowledge his wrongs and seek a way to be reconciled to his brother and his family, thankfully. So if we turn back into Genesis then, we've looked so far at some of the events that I think shaped who Judah was, became as a man at this time. And then we'll go into chapter 38. And this is, as I mentioned earlier, sort of, I think, a real period of darkness that Judah enters into now in his personal life, because he's now leaving his family altogether, whether he was really had, you know, a lot of strong bonds with them is questionable. At least he was physically there. But now he's leaving his family, the ecclesia, we could say, for an extended period of time, many years now. So from verse 1 and 2 of chapter 38, we can tell that this is not going to go well. Genesis 38, 1 and 2. And it came about at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went in to her. So he leaves his family, he leaves the ecclesia, and he immediately comes to another place and seeks out someone who's not from the ecclesia, not a godly person. At least it seems that way. Immediately sort of looks around. At least that's the way the record portrays it, and finds a woman and marries her. Now, it says that Judah saw a daughter and took her and went in unto her. And this we may just read this and sort of glance over it, but this has happened a number of times with men failing badly in the Bible, and one of those was Samson. So it's very similar language to when Samson chooses women in Judges 14 and 16. Chapter 14, he chooses one of the daughters of the Philistines and for a wife, and in Judges 16 he sees a harlot of Gaza. And we know Samson clearly had a problem with his eyes, the lust of the eyes. And in Samson's case, his eyes were put out. He was blinded after his capture. So that weakness was taken away from him in that sense. Also, David's sin with Bathsheba, 2 Samuel 11, verse 2, says that from the roof he saw a woman washing. Again, the lust of the eyes setting into motion a chain of failures and sins. It's also the same way that Shechem reacts towards seeing Dinah in Genesis 34. He saw her and took her. And this might be, you know, we might say this is a bit of a different case. It does say that he lay with her by force. But it also does say that Shechem did love her, and he did want to to stay with her and take her for his wife. But it's another example of this seeing, and this phrase, saw her coming out in a negative way. So it's the same language, here with Judah taking this wife. And it's the same language of Judah as he turns into Tamar later in the chapter, verse 15 and 16. He saw her and he turned aside to her, even though he doesn't know it's Tamar at the time. But it's that lust of the eyes that is continuing to be a problem for him at this time. So it's in chapter 38 that Judah really hits a low point. I think probably the low point in his life. He's lost two sons. He's lost the wife that we mentioned. She died as well. He's committed a grievous sin with his daughter-in-law. However, it does seem that Judah has now realized his wrongdoing. And he's brought so low that he is able to recognize his huge faults and inadequate placement of priorities. So at the end of, or near the end of the chapter, in chapter 38, verse 26, this is the last thing we hear about Judah until chapter 42. It says that Judah recognized them, his signet ring and his staff, the things that he gave to Tamar as a pledge. He recognized them and said, "She is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son, Shelah, and he did not have relations with her again." So those two phrases, "she is more righteous than I think we gain insight into where Judah is at now. He's sort of turning around in his mind. And he did not have relations with her again. I mean, that we could view that as sort of an innocuous piece of detail in the text. But I think, you know, it's a real end to the way, that Judah was acting up until this point. So I think it was a real mental change that Judah made. So chapter 38 is really the low point, but I think it's also a turning of a corner for Judah in becoming a mature man. It's not like he's a particularly young man here either. I think you know, there's evidence that he's somewhat middle-aged. But he's turning that corner and becoming a mature man at this point. And then the record is silent on Judah until chapter 42. We have, you know, the events of Joseph in Egypt. But if we turn over to chapter 42, we'll pick it up again because we know the backstory of Joseph in Egypt and what's going on with the famine. So in chapter 42, verse 3, it says then that the 10 brothers of Joseph went down to buy grain from Egypt. And we know that Benjamin was not sent, and Joseph's in Egypt, so we conclude that Judah must have been there with them. So at some point, Judah returns from this land, from Hira the Adullamite, and from all these heartaches and failures that he's made in leaving the family and leaving the ecclesia. That he's turned back now and he's back with the family. So we'll just work our way through these events fairly quickly because I think we know them fairly well. But they come down to buy the grain, as we know. Joseph retains Simeon in Egypt and demands that the youngest brother be brought back, Benjamin. So if we just contrast Reuben's pledge in chapter 46 to his father and Judah's in chapter 43, we'll see a bit of a difference there. So Reuben's pledge in chapter 42, verse 36 says, "Their father Jacob said to them, 'You have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more and Simeon is no more, and you would take Benjamin. All these things are against me.' Then Reuben spoke to his father, saying, 'You may put my two sons to death if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my care, and I will return him to you.' But Jacob said, 'My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he alone is left. If harm should befall him on the journey you are taking, then you will bring my gray hair down to Sheol in sorrow.'" So not really much of a desirable pledge to make from the perspective of Jacob, really. You know, if you're saying, you know, if I fail in my journey, you can also kill your grandchildren. That's not the nicest thing in my mind to offer as surety. But then Judah's promise in chapter 43, and picking it up at verse 8, where Judah said to his father Israel, "Send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, we as well as you and our little ones. I myself will be surety for him. You may hold me responsible for him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame before you forever." I think that's a bit more what we would expect to hear if we're trying to convince you know, Jacob to part with his beloved youngest son. And Judah is really beginning now to put himself on the line while trying to make things right. Even the language itself about how Judah addresses his father is different to Reuben's. So notice also the language in chapter 44 and in verse 14. When Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, he was still there, and they fell to the ground before him. So it's Judah and his brothers. It's not Reuben and his brothers. It's not one of the others. It's Judah. So Judah now appears to really be leading the family unit and the brethren in this way, especially in this journey. And Judah is the one to speak and entreat Joseph. He has assumed headship of the family. Reading there from chapter 44, verse 16. So Judah said, "What can we say to my Lord? What can we speak? And how can we justify ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Behold, we are my Lord's slaves, both we and the one in whose possession the cup has been found." But he said, "Far be it from me to do this. The man in whose possession the cup has been found, he shall be my slave. But as for you, go up in peace to your father." Then Judah approached him and said, "O my Lord, may your servant please speak a word in my Lord's ears, and do not be angry with your servant, for you are equal to Pharaoh. My Lord asked his servant, saying, 'Have you a father or a brother?' We said to my Lord, 'We have an old father and a little child of his old age. Now his brother is dead, so he alone is left of his mother, and his father loves him.' Then you said to your servants, 'Bring him down to me, that I may set my eyes upon him.' But we said to my Lord, the lad cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die. You said to your servants, however, unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you will not see my face again. Thus it came about when we went up to your servant, my father, we told him the words of my Lord. Our father said, go back, buy us a little food. But we said, we cannot go down. If our youngest brother is with us, then we will go down. For we cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. Your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore me two sons, and the one went out from me, and I said, surely he is torn in pieces, and I have not seen him since. If you take this one also from me, and harm befalls him, you will bring my gray hair down to Sheol in sorrow. Now, therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the lad is not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, when he sees that the lad is not with us, he will die. Thus your servants will bring the gray hair of your servant, our father, down to Sheol in sorrow. For your servant became surety for the lad to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then let me bear the blame before my father forever. Now therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the lad, a slave to my Lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers. For how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me, for fear that I see the evil that would overtake my father? So especially the last few verses there where he's really entreating Joseph, it's Judah's speech and entreatment towards Joseph that finally causes Joseph to break down emotionally and reveal himself to his brethren. So Judah and the brothers receive Joseph's forgiveness, and there is no mention of hard feelings of what has happened over the years in the past. And through the past few chapters regarding the trips to Egypt, Judah has shown his spiritual growth and acceptance of responsibility. And so the entire household, as we know, prepares to journey to Egypt. And just as another note on Judah, in chapter 46 and verse 28, just notice that where Judah is now in terms of being a leader. So it says in Genesis 46, verse 28, now he sent Judah before him to Joseph to point out the way before him to Goshen, and they came into the land of Goshen. So Judah's really proven his worth now to his father, and proven that he has changed and is prepared to be a leader for his brethren. So we come to the blessings from his father in chapter 49. Reuben, Simeon, and Levi have been reminded of their failures in what Jacob has to say. And Judah, even though he is still blessed, I guess it would be sort of the first real blessing that was bestowed upon one of the sons. He's still addressed in order of birth, but it does the blessing itself does put him in that leadership position, firstborn status through that content of that blessing. So when we consider the tribe of Judah in our next class, we'll pick it up, I think, from here in the blessings given to Judah the man, rolling that into his descendants, a multitude, and one especially, and the picture of the spiritual nation. So from the man Judah, his life circumstances, events, low points, and his redemption, his turning back to the family, the ecclesia, I think we really learn that no one is too far gone for God to work with. He had to recognize his failures and his faults and want to turn things around. And seeing that attitude, God was prepared to help him, to redeem him, as he will with us or with anyone else who displays a sincere repentance and desire for God.